This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 1035.
It's Thursday evening, and next week, you might as well just take the week off. But for tonight, we've got a great show for you. My name's Gary Strubel. This is the Business Report. You're listening to Nova 1035. Coming up this evening, we're going to talk about the Sovereign Wealth Fund, the Bank of Namibia, coming to give us more details and answer our questions. Lazarus Jacobs is in the spotlight. My word, what a great interview with a guy, a poet, an author, a businessman. He's worked in government as well, so he's been around this country. He's got some interesting things to say. Michael Oppel tells us what's happening in SA. They're building 100-meter flagpoles, maybe. And then the wild side of economics with Floris Berg. And then also we'll be talking about the Sanlam Bridge program. So lots coming up in the show, but for now it's time for the Biz News Flash Briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of Biz News.
With your Biz News, I'm David Bishop. The leadership in the two Kavango regions have requested an audience with the Minister of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform, Kalish Schletwein, on the revitalization of all green schemes in the country, saying they're in a vacuum regarding the new plans. Annual consumer price inflation remained unchanged at 5.9% in April 2022, Statistics SA reported on Wednesday. This is the third time in 5 months that the rate hit 5.9%, which is close to the Reserve Bank's upper target rate for inflation of 6%. This has added to predictions that the South African Reserve Bank will announce a significant interest rate increase later today. The United States, several global development banks, and other groups are working swiftly to bring to bear financial, policy engagement, and technical assistance to prevent starvation prompted by the war in Ukraine, rising food costs, and climate damage to crops. Through the scheme, tens of billions of dollars will be spent on supporting farmers, addressing the fertilizer supply crisis, and developing land for food production, among other issues. And according to a new report by US-based economic consultants Analysis Group, the metaverse, a universe that combines augmented, virtual, and mixed reality, could play a key role in sub-Saharan Africa's economic development, contributing about 639 billion Namibian dollars to the GDP of sub-Saharan Africa in the next decade. I'm David Bishop. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Welcome back. It's the Business Report on Nova 1035. Time now for our lead story. The lead story brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes. Let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. Our lead story this evening is a story that's been coming a long time and finally reached fruition this week. The Bank of Namibia and the Ministry of Finance last week officially launched the Namibia Sovereign Wealth Fund. Known as the Velvichia Fund, it'll have a balanced mandate where 70% of the assets bought are risky assets or assets that carry risk like equities, while the rest made up of fixed income assets, real estate, and price and private equity. Now, for more on this, we welcome to the studio Anthea Ungermund. Welcome to the Business Report.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm happy to be here today.
Tell us a little bit about your role at the Bank of Namibia.
Sure. So I am the Deputy Director of Foreign Markets. So my team is responsible for managing the reserves of the country. And this is also the team who will be involved with the management of the fund that we've just launched.
Right. So let's start in layman's terms. We like breaking things down. Bank of Namibia, this isn't a bank where you can go get a credit card
or
go and deposit your kids' birthday funds. What is the role of a central bank as simply as you can in an economy?
Yeah, so we ensure the financial stability in the economy. So we've got a very big regulatory role that we play with regards to monitoring the banks that operate in the economy. We also have to have an inflation mandate. So we have to keep an inflation at bay. So I'm sure you've heard a lot about the inflation spiraling out of control right around the world. And this is where central banks have a huge role to play. The department that I am part of, we specifically focus on the foreign exchange reserves. So we manage those portfolios on behalf of the country.
Okay, cool. And where do those reserves come from?
So those reserves come from a number of sources. I mean, we've got some, we're part of the SACU revenue pool. So we receive a portion of funds every quarter from that generic pool. And so that forms part of the reserves that we manage.
Okay. And held in all sorts of different denominations?
Yes. So we've got, because a lot of our exposures and a lot of our trade is with South Africa, we've got quite a big portion in South African rand, but we also hold a significant portion in USD and some other currencies, some other hard currencies.
Okay, so let's get on to the fund. Launched last week. It's been, guys have been talking about it for years. It has proponents that are very positive to it and it has opposition as well. So what is the thinking of a sovereign fund?
Sure. So there are different sovereign wealth funds, how they're structured right around the globe. I will speak to the one that we have launched specifically. So our sovereign wealth fund will have two components. The first component is the stabilization account. And what we intend to do here is that in times where government revenues might not be as robust, in times of economic downturns, we hope to have this buffer in place that we are able to tap into when the economy turns. So that's the first account. The second one is the intergenerational account. And in that account, we aim to save today's revenue and income derived from today's resources for future generations. So that is a fund that we intend to grow to a specific portion of GDP before we ever start tapping into it. But the intention is that we want future generations to benefit from any resources that we are currently using. So for example, one thing that will filter into the fund and one revenue stream, one income stream for that fund will be the sales of diamonds. So a specific portion of that would be channeled into the fund. If we end up finding oil, a specific portion of any revenues and any royalties would be channeled into the fund. And the thinking is that one day, if this country doesn't have any more diamonds, I mean, these are non-renewable resources that we are tapping into. When we reach the point where those resources might be depleted, we want something to show for it. So this is the intention of that second portion of the fund.
Okay. So if I was to turn this into sort of the way we run our personal finances, the one is a bit of a savings account for rainy days.
Yes.
And the other one is almost like a pension fund.
It's a long-term investment.
Where we see the benefits of today's activity in a long time from now.
100%.
All right. So we're effectively talking about diverting funds from streams. Those funds would have, under the current situation, before the fund is launched, would have hit the fiscus.
Correct.
So does that
What's happening?
Does that not create a little bit that the dam isn't filling up like it should?
Sure. So we've considered that as one. So how we've gone about it is that revenue needs to be a certain percentage of GDP before we are able to tap into the SACU receipts. So it's... It's structured in such a way that from a fiscal perspective, we should be on a stable footing before we can take money and put it away. So we might have the case where this fund won't see any inflows for the next year or two if we don't have the capacity to fund it. So what we've done is we've seeded the fund and we've essentially established a framework. So there are firm rules in place where funds will be channeled into the fund. So like the example that I gave, if we do end up discovering or if the oil that we've discovered is economically viable, then there's already this framework in place. So we won't need to be caught on the back foot. Then we can already have the framework in place and channel the funds into here. So we've got seed capital right now that we aim to invest and grow to the best of our abilities. And once we are able to contribute to the different portions of this fund, we will go ahead and do so.
How big is our little money pile at the moment?
Our little money pile is, well, the fund is based in US dollars. So it's just under 20 million USD at the moment.
All right. And there's a, as I mentioned in the preamble, there's a bit of a split on that. 70% can be risk carrying.
So the two accounts, the two legs will be managed according to their aims and their investment horizons. The stabilization fund, because it is a shorter term investment, it's the investment horizon there is around 3 years, and the aim is to act as this buffer. So we do expect government to tap in times of economic downturn. So that portion of the fund will not have a risky asset allocation. So we will be mainly invested in fixed income instruments for that portion of the fund. So your nominal bonds, your inflation-linked bonds, and your money market instruments. The intergenerational portion, that portion of the fund is a longer-term investment horizon, at least of 10 years. And the aim is also really just to save for future generations. So in that portion of the fund, that's where our more aggressive asset allocation comes in. And that is where our more or less 70% allocation towards risky assets would come in.
Okay. So let's just talk safeguards for a second. One of the elements that was listed as examples, and I'm not sure if that was official or just interpretation, was private equity. At its best, private equity is risky and is investing in other people's businesses to some extent. What are the safeguards around the asset management that we're not making dumb decisions, that we're not believing a spreadsheet? We've seen major
someone came to tell us
everywhere.
A nice story, and we
exactly. They said, yes. "Listen, 10 cents never going to stop," and we chucked our cash in there. Yeah. And 10 cents, as we've seen this week, share prices collapsed because the conditions have changed. So, what are the safeguards around that form of asset management that isn't generally in sort of fiscal policy's wheelhouse to be adaptive enough, or perhaps even experienced enough to be able to see through?
Yeah.
To the business layers.
So from the asset management perspective, what we're really trying to do is to draw on some of our internal expertise, but also we recognize that we don't operate in a vacuum, and we can also benefit from some external expertise too. So we've been engaging with some global asset managers on this. We've run an optimization to determine, based on risk and return characteristics, what could be an optimal asset allocation for this fund. And this is the one that I chatted to earlier. But again, this is in widespread consultation with broader figures to just sanity check and make sure that we are not going off on a tangent here. And also, most of the products that we're currently looking at would potentially be passive investment options. So, and the private equity component that we've incorporated would be listed. It would be a listed private equity vehicle that we might be investing in, versus just someone showing up at your door and asking for some funds. So we have tried to build in some safeguards. We've put in specific risk parameters when we were doing our optimization, so that we can make sure that the fund is not going to be that the return and risk profile is optimized. But just on that, I would like to highlight that given the nature of the equity markets, you are inevitably going to see some times of downturn. This is going to happen. So the risk reward relationship, we must just be cognizant of. So I think we just need to have appreciation for that in the short term, we might see some pullbacks, especially with what we're seeing globally right now with the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. I mean, that has really taken its toll on the equity markets, along with the inflationary environment that we're seeing. So we can anticipate to see some months of drawdown, but in the long run, equities do have a higher potential for reward than what you would see in your normal fixed income instruments.
Okay, so let's put this in context. We've got a trade deficit at the moment of 3 billion a month. We've put 3 billion NAM dollars. We've put 300 million odd into a fund. Realistically, that feels, while the notion perhaps, not perhaps, definitely, it's a wonderful notion.
Yeah.
Have we passed the hats around the rest of the world and said, can you help a mate out? Have we asked for some petrol money on the way? Is there is there a mechanism by which other nations can assist this notion if we can't put enough money into it? Because really, from where you start is from where you go. We wouldn't expect, under current conditions in the world, massive revenue flows in the short term. So how do we make that pile bigger? It's a rambling question, forgive me, but it's it feels like a little bit of money compared to the problems we face.
It is a little bit of money.
And a little bit doesn't grow into a big bit quickly. So yes. Are there other ways for us to do this?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, the one portion of the fund will get some inflows from our royalties. So that wouldn't be dependent on.
But that's only if the money's there. In other words,
yes.
If we're not suffering a drought, if we're not going through pullbacks, if the rand isn't sinking again,
yes,
if South Africa keeps the lights on, you know, there's lots of factors here that aren't at the moment in 100%. Place.
We have also built into the framework, the bill that we're busy working on and busy finalizing, an option for corporates who, for example, think or agree that this is a noble cause, especially based on how transparent we plan on being with the fund. So we've got our annual financial reports that we'll be making public. We have committed to managing the fund in line with the Santiago principles. So that's a set of 24 principles seen as best practices for sovereign wealth funds. So that accountability and transparency and good governance is something that we've committed to to managing the fund according to. And so we're hoping that that would give people confidence that if they would like to contribute to the fund, there's definitely an avenue that we've built into the framework for them to be able to do so, accompanied by how transparent and accountable we intend on being with this fund.
Okay. And any opportunity for debt into this fund?
For
debt?
What do you mean by that?
Borrow money to invest it?
No, I don't know. We're not going to borrow money to invest money. No.
Okay. When can we expect the first investments to be made? When do we expect the first things to happen from the fund?
So the money is already in USD at the moment. So we are in advanced discussions with some providers of passive investment vehicles. So we can probably expect the fund to be fully invested. Well, I mean, right now it's not sitting and earning nothing. It's already earning some cash externally. But our strategy will probably take another few weeks to put in place.
Okay. And just lastly, from an investment profile perspective, are there certain sectors or markets or territories that you guys are kind of leaning towards that you think will be good initial steps?
Sure. So we are leaning into US equities, for example. We're leaning into global equities. The bonds that we want to invest in have very strict ratings criteria as well. So we are trying to be quite conservative on that front too. But in essence, I mean, we've got a very, very broad asset mix. We want to be well diversified in the fund. So I think that's also how you protect yourself. You want to build a robust and a well diversified portfolio to be able to withstand some global shocks. Of course, in some instances, all asset classes go down in sync. But generally, that would allow you a bit of a buffer from being able to draw on different asset classes when specific ones face particular pain.
Anthea Angerman from the Bank of Namibia, all the best with your first steps in what is a brave and bold new initiative from the government in thinking about future generations. Thanks for joining us on the Business Report.
Thank you very much.
That's Anthea Angerman from the Bank of Namibia talking about the officially launched Sovereign Wealth Fund. So it will be known as the Velvichia Fund. And we look forward to hearing more updates as the investments are made and we start getting report backs. A bold move from the Bank of Namibia. That is this evening's lead story. And this lead story brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
It's the Business Report with Gary Strubble. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
It's the Business Report on Nova 1035. Welcome back. And it's time now for our spotlight feature. And my favorite part of the show, we get to speak to so many interesting people and share their stories, their ideas, their thoughts, and their commentary on where we are at the moment. And joining us in the studio this evening, a man I've met a couple of times and enjoyed every discussion we've had, Lazarus Jacobs. Lazarus, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Gary. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're not a stranger to the microphone, so I won't be as gentle with you as I am to many of the less experienced broadcasters that we have often in the studio. Let's start out with at the beginning. Born in Grootfontein, at the time under very difficult circumstances in a country that was under oppression from another country and that had its own challenges. Just give us a sense of your childhood in Grootfontein.
Well, I never realized how privileged I grew up socially until in my adult life. And I'll tell you why. Because when I grew up in Grootfontein, the town had about just over 3,000 residents.
So it was
so, Kleinfontein. And Grootfontein was one of those socially, in terms of the black community, it was a socially highly integrated community. That's why until today people are confused about what so-called tribe I am. It was like, Lars, we can't actually place your accent, because when I grew up, Grootfontein was very, very integrated socially. And it was one of those things that everybody knew everybody, and everybody, if you did something, any parent had had the right to discipline you. It was never an issue of whose child are you and so on. But there was also the other side of Grootfontein, like you correctly said, which was a highly segregated town. And I'm still old enough to remember that there was a time that people in Grootfontein, black people, were not allowed to buy white bread or white sugar. And I grew up at a time where black people were not allowed to go into certain shops. It was for whites only. When I had to go to high school, I had to find a black high school to go to, although there was a high school in Grootfontein. So that's where I grew up. But I think what shaped my outlook in life from a very young age is that my mother ran a shebeen at our house to supplement the family income. And that's where I got to meet people from all walks of life, different tribes, different. And I used to sit and listen to these adults telling stories. And then I think that's what also formed my sense of humor, because I used to listen to these guys talking to them. It was never violence. It was always people like making fun of each other, you know, like a typical bar telling stories, all kinds of things. So
everyone wants to have a good time.
Exactly. People came there to have a good time. And I think that's what shaped, and that's why I'm passionate about social integration. That's why I'm passionate about people getting along. That's why I'm passionate about when I started doing comedy that I used to do, stories about racial integration and things like that. So I used to say those things on stage when black people were afraid to say about white people, because that was my background. I said I could find a way to bring people together through humor, because that has been shaped from my childhood.
Another thing I've noticed in many people I've spoken to is you're the eighth of nine children. My father-in-law is the 10th of 10.
Wow.
There's a certain amount of resilience that comes from being the smallest in a big family.
Very true.
Where you're used to just fighting for your share. You don't assume anything's yours. You've got to fight for it. Is that something you feel?
100%. Because, and that's why I have a mouth. Because I was physically smaller than my siblings. And I used to talk my way out of things, situations. Even at school, people always say that last you might have been bullied. I was like, nobody bullied me because I had a mouth on me. You know, you had to be very, very careful if you wanted to take me on. And I also grew up, since I'm this, like you said, I'm the eighth of nine. So I had older siblings, and also all my friends were always older than me for some reason. My friends were on average 3 or 4 years older than me, because I used to talk so much.
And for that reason, it's not quite as easy to get intimidated.
No. Could never be intimidated. Yeah.
But, given that you've always been very vocal, as you say, sort of a path in high school into acting and into a more sort of performance lifestyle, seemed quite natural.
It was because
something that you felt that you could get to quickly.
Right, because I mean, whenever the teacher asked a question, I was the first one to volunteer. Whenever there was a dull moment in the class or in school, I was the guy. I was always surrounded by people who were, especially during break, they were always surrounded by other kids who wanted to listen to my stories. I used to make up stories and make fun of people and things like that. So that was a natural path to performance. So whenever somebody had to perform like a poem or whatever, I was always the one who was asked, Lars, can you please come and say something? Come and tell stories and stuff like that, you know. So it was a natural path, yeah.
But then, of course, real life hits and you need to get a job.
Yeah.
And you get a job as a clerk.
Yeah.
And that's fun.
The Department van Waterwezen.
I mean, tell me about that. You would have been a young black man in a segregated environment.
Right.
who would have been popular in your own sector,
right.
And then you walk into South African run bureaucracy.
Right.
How did you adapt?
It was a shock because first of all, there was literally my first time I came to Windhoek. So I went to high school in Swakopmund. So I came to Windhoek. So when I came to Windhoek, I literally came to Windhoek as an adult. So that in itself was a shock. And then I came to the city, which was totally different from what I knew. There was everybody's in their little silos. Nobody's talking to each other, even in their working environment and so on. For the first time, I was experiencing power, political power, as a young person, as a child. But when I became an adult, I walked into the Department of Water Affairs, and you could clearly see it's highly segregated. There was always the white colleagues sitting one side, the colored colleagues sitting the other side, and I was the only black person in that office. So I was offered a job as a clerk. And you know what I did my first year? The only thing I did was every day, because I could speak Afrikaans, English, and Oshawamba, which is my mother tongue. And so there were these guys who were construction workers working for the Department of Construction under Water Affairs. And they were illiterate. So if they wanted to go on leave, they usually used to come to the office, and I had to complete their leave application for a year. That's all I did. I knew them so well. So I knew their employment numbers by heart already, because you come here and say, you are 10073 and things like that. That's all I did. Complete, and I'll tell them, okay, make a cross here. That's all I did for a year. There was. What did they say? We do what we have to do in order to do what we want to do.
And what you wanted to do was act, and you wanted to get into performance. Right?
Absolutely. So, that's what I wanted to do. And that's what I did to keep myself busy at the time. Was I started writing plays because I had so much time. I was literally sitting in the office going crazy.
For hours and hours.
I started writing plays because I did theater in school. So I started writing plays just to pass time. And I formed a little theater group and we used to rehearse in the evenings and then perform over weekends. That's what kept me busy.
And that led to work at the NBC.
Absolutely. After 3 years of 4 years of working for the Department of Water Affairs, I had this amazing opportunity. So I wrote this play called I've Been to the Mountaintop. And somebody at the NBC, a producer, saw this and he was totally shocked. Remember, it was just just after independence. And they were looking for stories, for Namibian stories. They were looking for Namibians, especially black Namibians, to go and work for the NBC. So when he saw that, he was shocked that I wrote the play. And then they offered me a job as a continuity scriptwriter at NBC.
And all those little bits between the programs.
Yes.
And now,
we are going to see Sylvester Stallone in Rambo. So those are the bits that you used to do, yeah.
Your life now, you've gone into business.
Yeah.
You spent a little bit closer to the heart of power.
Yeah. Quite a whole lot, actually.
But being an entrepreneur is very different from the almost dream world in our business. We have many presenters, and mm-hmm. it's almost sometimes like you live in an alternate universe to reality.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance those two as you went into business? Sometimes you are met with the hard facts of decisions and people and mm-hmm. HR and rules and policies and mm-hmm. regulations. How do you balance those two things?
So the most important thing is, I've realized, and it took me a while to get there, was to say, I need to create a niche for myself in the business. So I wanted to go into the type of business that I enjoy. So we started with an advertising agency at the time. So that gave me that creative output. And I was involved in developing adverts and things like that. So that's the creative stuff. An advert is nothing but a story. And since I'm into stories and writing stories, so that's what did it. So, but it also was almost like a hook that I was sucked into that I never actually, before I realized what happened, it was too late. That the business started growing. So we just got out of advertising, and then before you know, we were into travel retail, and we're into oil and gas exploration, into fishing and so on. So, but what I did in order for me to stay sane, I always try to find whatever business we get involved in. What is it in that business that appeals to me? And I'm also lucky that I have a business partner who is into chasing business and things like that. Yeah, the hard stuff. And I was always like the people's person type of thing. So if we have to do a business presentation, I'm the one who's doing the presentation. I'm doing the writing the proposals. And I still love it.
Yeah.
although there's still the numbers game and all of this, but I love doing the research, doing a presentation, and he identifies the business opportunity. So it's all about creating a niche for yourself. But the third wheel to your question is the fact that all of that, there's always this overwhelming political thing that hangs over you. And I'll explain. If there's no way you're going to do business in Namibia without having access to some level of political power. Not access in the sense that they need to open doors for you, but you will interact with them whether you like it or not. Because 60% of our GDP is government. So public procurement is probably one of the largest employers in the country. So it helped the fact that I was the finance minister's personal assistant. So that's where I built the network.
It does help.
Yeah. it built the network. So when I pick up the phone and call and I say to somebody, man, I want to come and say, oh, you're listening. Oh, okay, cool. That opens doors. Then once you open the door, then what? That's where the hard work comes in. So there's no point in me asking, like, please give me a meeting. I come into a meeting and I present rubbish. But the hard work was always, okay, once the door has been opened, are you going to make use of that opportunity you are given? Yeah.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the challenges you face today after the break. But
okay.
Now we get to judge you on your music choice.
Okay.
So what song have you selected for our listeners?
Keep the Faith by Michael Jackson.
If you call out loud, will you get inside? Through the heart of your surrender, to your advice, and you can say, like you understand, but the power's in believing, so give yourself a chance, 'cause you can climb the highest mountain, swim the deep sea, all you need is the will to want it and a little self-esteem, so keep the faith. Just a matter of time before your confidence
That's Michael Jackson, Keep the Faith, the choice of Lazarus Jacobs, who's our guest in the spotlight this evening. You're listening to The Business Report. Poet, author, comedian, businessman, so many things that you that you're interested in. Let's talk for a second about your role at Paragon Investments. You guys are a diversified company. You've got investments and businesses in all range of industries. Diversification is often a risky thing for a partnership, as you do, where there's a couple of guys. You're not backed by massive corporations or multinationals. Which of these industries grabs your fancy the most?
I really, really like media. Love media. Media and marketing. That's my creative output. I love that. And I love it's because people are starting to struggle about defining what is media, because everything is media these days. You know, the minute you pick up your cell phone or your computer, you are engaging.
How you dress is media, right?
Exactly. I mean, look at you. You understand, you've got Future Media logo on it. That's media you're communicating to me. So, and I love where we are going as a species. How we're developing media as humanity, and where it's taking us, and what it is doing to us to us as a species. I mean, look, without media, Elon Musk will not be doing Tesla. He would not be going exploring Mars and all kinds of things. So, I fancy media. I really love media.
And that leads us obviously to your role at the NBC. So
yeah,
that's a tough gig, right?
It is.
You're coming in from business into what's supposed to be business,
right?
But is hard to run like that given the nature of a state broadcaster.
Yeah.
So perhaps as much as you could tell us, how is that? Your job is as chairman of the board?
Right. Non-executive.
Non-executive. So you don't have to get into the guts of the organization, invariably the stuff rises and you've got to deal with it.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that. How challenging is it to be the chairman of the state broadcaster?
So NBC is a challenge. It's a major challenge because, like you correctly said, it's a public broadcaster, not a state broadcaster. It's a public broadcaster. And here's the thing. Everybody, all 2.6 million of us in the country, are direct stakeholders in NBC. And because NBC, by its very nature, is a service brand, you are only as good as your last customer. You know, we can have a good news bulletin. Everybody loves it. And then the next day we do a sports program and nobody likes. Or we have a problem with our satellite uplink and things like that. And then you understand, it's an organism that's morphing all the time. But what I've realized that, just like any other organization, whether it's Future Media or whatever, if you have a very good, strong, committed team behind you, there's nothing that will face you. Here's the thing, what I did is when I was appointed chairperson, I got the management team together and I said to them, I want you to know two things. One, I have complete faith in you. I have complete faith in what you are doing. That's where I'm coming. You're gonna have to prove me wrong. Okay, but we're starting positive. We're not starting negative. Like, so sometimes people say, I need to come and clean up and you guys are messing up. That's starting negative and working towards a positive. I realized that strategy doesn't work. And I meant it when I said, I have faith in you, because as long as we are able to listen to radio, watch television and stuff, it means that you guys are waking up every day to make that happen. So I have faith in you. Secondly, I will fight for you. Leave the fights to me, the political fights and getting the money and stuff. I will do that. All you need to do is the operations. All right? So, and then they were a little bit skeptical because it was like, it's a political appointment. Is he here for an agenda? Is he here to fire people? Is he here to push a political party? And I said to them, you guys don't know which party I support. You just assume. I don't know which political party you support. So I'll just assume. So let's put this apart. Okay. The third challenge was NBC, by its very nature, is defined by the news department, because NBC News is NBC's largest seller. So we had to work very, very hard to put up a professional team in our news department. And I said, we are here to serve the Namibian nation. But we must also not forget that NBC, by its very founding statement, is supposed to promote government. So we have to promote government, because people need to know what their government is doing. That's why their government pays for the institution. Now, the fun, the one thing that I really, really enjoy about NBC is I enjoy working with the Director General and his management team. I enjoy working with my fellow colleagues on the board. We've never, and I'm using the word here, never here, we've never had any major conflicts on board level. Whenever somebody made a suggestion, we said, yes, let's try it. If ever somebody came up with a proposal, we said, yes, let's try it. And I've never had any fights with my management team. The strike that we've experienced was a strike that was ongoing, was going on for a very, very, very long time. And I said to them, look, I'm the one person who believes that if there's money, you guys need to be paid what you deserve. But you going on strike right now in the middle of a pandemic when profits are down, when people are losing their jobs, it's ill-timed and ill-considered. It hurts me to know that you guys are going on strike, and unpaid strike for that matter, but there's absolutely nothing I can do. After that, and I realized that I had to communicate a lot during that process. It was never a situation, well, you go on strike, I go to my house, whatever. Every day I was engaging the union. Every day I was engaging some of the leaders of the strike and say, guys, this thing is just going to, it's a lose-lose situation. Let's get back to work. But I'm so happy to say we are back to work now. You've seen we've introduced brand new programs. The energy is different. Like they say, you need to break up to make up. So we are in the makeup space now.
So you're clearly passionate about the media space.
Oh, totally.
Just in closing, you've got a diversified holdings company. You have a thriving career on the side or in front or at the back or wherever you think it is as an entertainer and a performer. You have an enormously responsible job. As chairman of the public broadcaster and all the responsibility that comes with that in an African context. And we're in tough times. There's no doubt. The government's in tough times. We have a leadership sometimes that seems just a little bit out of touch with a different age group. And we know that that's universal around the world.
Yeah, it's a volatile age group. Yeah,
but inside an African context, it's even more volatile because of the way older people are expected to be respected and listened to without question as a societal thing. That also seems to be eroding quicker. In Europe, it's been a problem for 50 years.
Yeah,
it's becoming a problem now. And my question is how hopeful are you that we will successfully navigate the next 5 to 10 years, which feels like the critical time period for Namibia to either start thriving as an African nation or to start sliding as we've seen many African states do?
Okay, so what I'm going to say might ruffle some feathers, but this is my assessment of what's happening. You see, what we need to do is we are living in a time right now of denial. One thing we cannot deny is the fact that, let's just talk about leadership, that leadership needs to change. Not individuals, leadership. It's a generational thing, right? So we can only succeed if we have people in leadership who represent your population. You follow? I cannot go and become the coach of a girls' team. You understand? Girls' netball team. If I don't know netball and if I'm not a woman. So now let me juxtapose this to our leadership. We need to start getting more and more young people in our leadership positions. I'm not saying tomorrow you need to appoint a 40-year-old as a president of the country. What I'm saying is, like what the president did, start getting young people to be ministers, make them deputy ministers, make them MPs. Because if you appoint a 22-year-old as an MP, can you imagine by the time she's 30 and she wants to become a minister, can you imagine how great she will make, or he will be? We are caught between a leadership that is in denial that their time is gone, and a very, very impatient young population.
Yeah.
You understand? There's a verse in the Bible that says, if we don't rise, they will not fall. And here's the thing. In order, the young people are rising up now, and they are not rising up because they feel that they hate leadership or they hate the ruling party. It's just that they are looking at this about, you are not addressing my issues, right? Somebody said to me the other day, Lazarus, if you were to go and talk to these young people who are on strike right now, what are you going to tell them? I said, I'm not going to tell them. What I'm going to do is I'm going to listen to them. That's the problem. We all just want to tell them, stop doing this. Stop. Listen to them. We need to listen to what is. I don't agree with half the things they are saying. I don't agree with half the tactics, but I'm going to listen to them. It's only when we start listening to what these young people are saying that we can start formulating policies and develop strategies which will help them to become the citizens that we want them to be. Right now, what we are experiencing is a generational clash. That's all that's happening. And I always say to people, if you look at the Arab Spring was brought by young people, was started by young people. And you know why it started? It was started by somebody in Algeria who burned himself alive because he felt the police was harassing him every day. It takes a very, very small spark to cause a revolution. It took, whether you agree with Michael Amoshelelo or not, I don't agree with what he did, but you know what he did? It took him to shut down a gate at Chinatown to be arrested for us to have these young people. The question we need to ask ourselves is, do we really want to develop a country where a lot of young people have nothing to lose? You see, in closing, I want to end this with this question with what Martin Luther King said it in 64. There's nothing more dangerous than to build a society where a large segment of people in that society feel that they have nothing to lose. People who cares about the society, protects their society. Those who don't unconsciously try to destroy it. And that's what we're experiencing right now. We need to listen to what these young people, and what they want. Young people don't want a lot. Young people don't want a lot if we're listening to them. They want employment or to create the conducive environment for them to create their own employment. And thirdly, for them to have a say in how their country is governed. That's it. Surely we can achieve that.
Wise words. It's very uplifting to hear you state it so concisely and to feel perhaps from your lips to the ears of those in power, we might still achieve something. Lazarus Jacobs, thank you so much for joining us on the Spotlight. It's been a privilege to talk to you. And the best of luck.
Thank you.
All the journeys that you are undertaking.
Thank you. It was an honor to be invited. Thank you.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 103.5.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at MNZ Motors. MNZ Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Contact MNZ Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive or visit the MNZ Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything.
Time now, as always, to take a little peek over the fence and check out the crazy neighbors with our publishing partners, BizNews.com, of course. Michael, you're familiar with the Florida man syndrome in media, right?
I'm not. Tell me, Gary.
Okay, well, it's anytime a story starts with a man in Florida, you know that it's absolutely bonkers story. So, but we really are starting to get into the point. So when you speak to you every week, I'm almost inclined to say a man in South Africa because a 100-meter flagpole that costs 22 million rand, Michael, what, how? How is that a real thing?
Yeah, it's like the hold my beer thing. That's pretty much South Africa. So the Department of Arts and Culture, through the Minister Nathi Mthethwa, decides that in efforts of social cohesion and nation building, that South Africans need to know what our flag looks like. And I mean, these are his words. It's about educating people about the flag. So it is a monumental flag project. And you get these across the world. I think the tallest flag in the world is in Saudi Arabia. It's like a massive vanity project. And they're all over the world. But for some reason, somebody in arts and culture decided it was a good idea. And They commissioned a feasibility study to look at initially six locations in Gauteng. They settled on Freedom Park in Pretoria. And it's about 120 meters, between 80 and 120 meters, but on the top end, 120. And then that's the pole, which the minister says will reinvigorate the steel industry. What a bold-faced lie that is. And then he says the flag itself will be 10 by 15 meters, and you'll be able to see it during the day and at night. Stop the presses, Gary. You'll be able to see the flag at night. It's going to cost us 22 million rand. And thankfully, I'm able to report that after much outrage by the South African public across many sectors and even across the tripartite alliance partner, COSATU, saying, no, this is ludicrous. You've got to stop this. The minister this morning announcing that they're going to review this project.
All right. Well, we know that's code word for that was dumb. We'll do something else. More dumb stuff has been, and there's been, you know, since the Gupta's bombshells started dropping, there's been this constant refrain in the background that this sort of money doesn't happen in brown paper packets, and that the entire financial services industry must be in some way complicit in allowing these sorts of transactions to take place. There's part of the Apple and Aaron show, the next episode, Michael, is Aaron Richards discussing how 280 million rand in taxpayer money made its way through the financial system. Give us a brief oversight there.
Yeah, and that was my first question to Advocate Aaron Richards. How does one move 280 million rand out of South Africa? And you can only do it with the complicity and with the knowledge of the South African financial institutions, the banks. And 82% of that 280 million rand that went from the Free State Agriculture Department to Estina, which was the vehicle through which they... it was a shell company they set up. There was a guy called Kamal Vasram who headed up Estina. He used to sell computers for the Gupta Sahara computers. He's not a guy who knew anything about dairy farming, but hey, why would he need to? And then this company, Estina, had less than 17 rand in its bank account prior to the prepayments, I think of 30 million rand, the first prepayment, eight tranches of payments that would ultimately come from the South African taxpayer to this Gupta company. 82% of that would then be laundered throughout the world, mostly into Dubai and Hong Kong, and then come back into South Africa to pay for things like the Gupta Sun City wedding, which was a multi-million rand event that spanned several days and, you know, was really a kind of middle finger to the South African taxpayer that our own money went, got laundered, came back and paid for that. An extraordinary story. Go check it out on Biz News TV and on the website.
Are we expecting just more on this one very briefly? I mean, it's clear that there would have been even the potential for wrongdoing from the South African banks in allowing these transactions. What happens next? Does someone have to lay a complaint with the Financial Services Board? Do the banks fess up? How do we get to the point that the corporates that facilitated these things are also, to some extent, at the very least, named?
So Advocate Richards, she has a bee in her bonnet about the lackadaisical, rather kid gloves way that the State Capture Inquiry handled the banks. Because Ian Sinton, who is the former head of legal for Standard Bank, because there were two accounts that Estina held. It was with FNB and Standard Bank. And when the head of legal, Ian Sinton, was before the State Capture Inquiry, they asked him, what eventually led you to closing the Gupta's bank accounts? And his answer was, oh, well, APSA closed their bank accounts. So it took another bank closing the bank accounts for them who gave banking facilities to the Guptas to go, ooh, we don't want to be the ones left holding the cards when the entire house comes down. So we're also going to close our bank accounts with them because the rest are starting to do it. So, I mean, it's a pathetic excuse, honestly. And there is a narrative out there that that the state capture inquiry honestly went way too soft on the banks for some or other reason. And Advocate Aaron Richards saying, why does somebody like the Pirate Protector or the Financial Intelligence Center not come out and investigate the banks for who was involved, who was complicit, and who we should be pointing the finger at here? Because, as you say, it's unthinkable that this should happen.
Well, lots more to come from this story. I'm sure we'll still be talking about the Guptas in 5 years' time. And then just lastly, briefly, Mike, we're nearly out of time, but a very interesting article from you about Karen Maugham is really developing a reputation of writing some pretty compelling stuff. There's a book called Nuclear, Inside South Africa's Secret Deal, that Karen Maugham and Kirsten Pearson have gone into it. Now, often these things are so complicated and so detailed that they sort of miss the public consciousness. So I suppose the question is, just how close was South Africa to closing this nuclear deal, which in all probability would have been financially and fiscally disastrous?
We had actually signed, and when I say we, the South African government had actually signed a kind of a working agreement, an MOU, with the Russian government that we would be using their state-owned entity for nuclear build, which is Rosatom, that we would be using Rosatom and committing the South African government to a roughly 1 trillion rand deal with the Russian government. That deal, which was for 9.6 gigawatts, 9,600 megawatts, would have made up about 23% of our energy mix. So if you just, and then thankfully, Gary, there was a little NGO called Earth Life Africa, and looked at this deal and said, no, it's completely unaffordable, but also at the very least, there was zero public participation. That is where the picks up, and it gives you a very nice, digestible, easy to understand background to this entire nuclear deal. Go check that out.
All right. Thanks, Michael. We'll leave it there for this evening. That's the Biz News Weekly Wrap here on The Business Report.
The Biz News Wrap is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Book your test drive today at MNZ Motors.
Gary Struble on The Business Report.
Welcome back. It's The Business Report here on Nova 103.5. And now it's time for the Market Watch. And for this evening's Market Watch, we are going to go on to the wild side. That is the wild side of economics. And the foundation document for this piece of radio is a newsletter article that's written by Floris Berg in the Capricorn Asset Management newsletter of April 22, entitled The Wild Side of Economics. And then the first sentence, one gray rhino has started its charge. Now, that's a very unusual start to a piece on economics. Floris Berg joins us live this evening. Floris, welcome to the show.
Hi, Gary. Hi to the listeners.
Tell us a little bit about the wild side of economics. It was a very entertaining article, but it had hawks and doves and black swans and gray rhinos. There's a little bit of zoo economics going on. Give us a bit of background.
Yes, I hope it doesn't sound too much like Animal Farm. it's just a bit of slang that we use in economics and the financial markets. And I think it's the human trend to try to label things in a way that can make sense to people or even to us in the economics and investment management field. So, it's the gray rhino concept is referring to risks that we see out there. I mean, it's like if you go on a safari drive and you see a rhino in the bush over there, you never know when it's going to charge and which way it's going to run, but at least you see it. So, the gray rhino refers to that sort of concept where you've got an awareness of risks out there, whereas the black swan is the concept of a risk that swoops from nowhere, something that you could not foresee at all. Like, for instance, if you take yourself back to 2019, the Black Swan event of the COVID pandemic was not foreseeable.
Okay, so Black Swan, COVID-19, and this gray rhino you speak about, is this inflation?
Amongst others, yes. So, for instance, if you think about other gray rhinos out there that we can actually identify, but we don't know which way it's going to go, is, for instance, let's call it the Chinese and Taiwan tensions, right? We know there's a risk there, but we honestly don't know which way it's going to go. And then you've got other things like the Chinese economy itself and the property market problems that's arising over there. That's another gray rhino. In other words, we see difficulties, but we don't know really what the extent of the impact is going to be.
Other examples would be the current Brexit impasse with the Northern Ireland backstop, Ukraine, Russia. Global warming still remains one of those massive imponderables as to the impact of extreme weather conditions over the next couple of years. But what sort of gray rhinos do we see here at home? Are there identified risks that we think are about to start charging here locally?
Yes, I think what you referred to for the domestic economy, the inflationary outlook is one of those where we do foresee a rising inflation rate in Namibia. I think it's obvious to anyone that the fuel price has risen exponentially. And what we're currently facing is a possible shift in inflation risks from the transport category to the food component. We've seen a huge run-up in food prices globally, especially in the grains, and we have not seen a real upswing in food inflation broadly in South Africa or Namibia. There are pockets of food inflation that we've seen rising very sharply, like sugar and oil, cooking oil, and that sort of.
Fleur, sorry, we know it's coming, right? I mean, a lot of the price protection is currently built in due to forward buying from the retailers on things like grains and so forth, where the supply is relatively predictable. We've seen the short term ones like oil, which has a short buying cycle, spike. But further stories coming out of South Africa is that they're expecting huge fuel price increases next month as their relief levy falls away. And there's still increased in pressure on oil. So we're anticipating further rises in fuel, right? So that does lead to a sort of a multiplier effect on food prices, given that we import most of our food.
Yes, we're going to see second round effects, as they call it. Which brings us to the hawks and doves that you also mentioned in the intro, where we have now in central bank monetary policy committees, in other words, the guys that agonize over where they are going to pitch interest rates. Within those committees, we also talk about hawks and doves in terms of, you know, the guys that are really focusing on the inflation cycle and the importance of having positive real interest rates in the economy in order to keep inflationary expectations also under control. Or then the hawks, and then you have the doves, which are mostly focused on the underlying economy, where rising interest rates is obviously a negative for economic growth, which is exactly the way that you want to try and control inflation. However, we've got extreme unemployment situations, both in South Africa and Namibia. We have fragile economic recoveries, and therefore you will have doves on the decision-making panels that say, no, look, we can't hike rates so much because we're going to choke off recoveries. And then you have the hawks that say, no, but our main focus is inflation. We need to control inflation, etc. And then you get into the debate where it is about whether monetary policy settings in a situation that we've got currently can actually or is actually able to have an impact on inflation, because what we currently have is cost push inflation.
Yeah.
Where the global oil price and the food price cycle and the fuel price cycle, very the monetary policy, there is very little that it's ability to really control those things.
All right, Fleur, so let me put you on the spot then. Because also in your article, you say we're looking at somewhere between 3 and 4% growth in the economy this year. But obviously, we have all these gray rhinos, which give us unknowables and potential impact. What should monetary policy be, do you think, in terms of how you think government should handle the next 12 months on this tight line where the monetary policy does have, you know, any kind of, does it put the brakes on rising food prices given scarcity? What do you think monetary policy should see over the next 12 months?
In my view, Gary, they should be patient. In other words, lift rates a little bit more, but very measured and gradual. And in other words, I would say lift rates by a maximum of another 50 basis points. In other words, two hikes of 25 basis points by the SARB and the Bank of Namibia, rather than trying to put the brakes on too sharply. To step on the brakes, you could have a negative effect on the economy as a whole.
Yeah.
Exactly. For the reason that I'm saying, we still, you know, the domestic cycle is very fragile still. And, you know, that brings me to another animal analogy, is that one, that of animal spirits. I think it was coined by the economist Keynes, where the economic cycle is, and also the investment markets, are many times driven by animal spirits, as we would label them. In other words, it has to do with confidence, whether people, especially in entrepreneurs, that drives growth, their confidence or the degree to which animal spirits is rising is an important indicator or a driver of the outlook.
And of course, you're talking here about bulls and bears, right? So we've seen huge fluctuations, especially on the NASDAQ and in foreign markets. Lots of global uncertainty, lots of volatility. Just very briefly, for us, because we're running out of time. Do you think we're in a bull market? And that's of course positive. That's where we see growth and we see sentiment positive. Or do you think we're currently in a bit of a bear market and inclining towards pessimism and withdrawal of capital risk?
I think the latter, to be short and sweet. However, we see very divergent trends amongst different markets. Like, for instance, you mentioned the equity markets or share markets, where we definitely on the verge of entering bear market globally and domestically, but we have seen quite a correction already. So it is also possible that we are reasonably close to bottoming out, but we see a bull market in oil and a bull market in energy,
yeah,
a bull market in grain prices. So, you know, it's a very mixed picture out there.
So in short, Fleurs, if I'm picking up what you're putting down, be careful with your exposure to risk. because it's not clear in which way the needles are moving at the moment, and all these gray rhinos around can be very, very unpredictable. Firoz Bhatt, thank you so much for joining us this evening. That's an article written by Firoz in the Capricorn Asset Management Newsletter of April 2022. You can get along to their website and subscribe and get that downloaded. Very interesting article about all the different animals used in the description of economics. And thanks, Firoz, for bringing those out in color for us. That's this evening's Market Watch here on The Business Report.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
Sunlum, in partnership with Startup Namibia, launched the 2022 Sunlum Bridge Program. To find out a little bit more about this, Angie Skoltz spoke to Laurentia Prinzonski from Sunlum.
Sunlum, in partnership with Startup Namibia today, has launched the 2022 Sunlum Bridge Program. Please tell us more about this program.
Sunlum CSI program aims to promote and to assist the government in its governmental objectives. We look at areas such as education, health, entrepreneurial and sports development, of which we believe the government prioritizes when it comes to development. So a few years ago, Sunlum initially started this entrepreneurship program called the Sunlum Innovation Works in partnership with the then Polytechnic of Namibia, which is now NUST. But we have changed a bit, a few things, and it is now called the Sunlum Bridge, still funded by Sunlum, but facilitated by Startup Namibia. So the Sunlum Bridge aims to provide young Namibians with the opportunity to acquire the necessary skills to run their business and receive the much needed seed capital to get them started. This program is open to young Namibians between the ages of 18 and 35 all over the country. Our idea with this is not just to help the entrepreneurs, but to support them through their journey, to mentor them, to coach them in order for them to put the funding to good use.
Tell us more about the pre-incubation program.
So during this four-week pre-incubation program, which will be facilitated by Startup Namibia, entrepreneurs will learn the basic business principles, which will help them further grow their business. And this will also give them the opportunity to network with other startups while they are receiving coaching and mentorship.
At the end of the program, how is the winner selected? What do you look at?
After the four-week pre-incubation program with the 30 participants, they will have a pitch event, which will then bring the number down to the top five winners. And these selected winners will continue with the program, which will see them receive $50,000 seed capital, coupled with training and mentorship. An overall winner will then be announced towards the end of the year to receive an additional $50,000. So the winner that is selected out of the five top winners, we will look at the overall improvement in their business. So we'll look at their pre and post investment. Pre, just looking at, you know, how the business looked at before there was seed capital pumped into this business, and then post investment now, how they look at their business now. You know, we look at revenue generation. Say, for example, if their plan was to increase their sales from selling a product that they only sold two products to five products now, have they managed to reach that target? If they wanted to set up a website, have they reached that target to set up the website, you know? We look at their contribution towards the high unemployment rate. And then also just we look at if they've plowed back into the community. So those are the nitty-gritties that we look at when we decide on the final winner at the end of the day.
And just the last question, what's your message to entrepreneurs that want to join the program?
I think to all entrepreneurs that want to join the program, but also just any entrepreneur out there, my advice would be keep at your dream. Do not let any, you know, small mind tell you that your dream is too big. There's always a saying that says, once you can dream it, you can achieve it. There's a quote by Mrs. Rose Marie Peters that says, in this entrepreneurship journey, you don't fail. You get an opportunity to learn again and again. And this is what Sunlum and Startup Namibia want to do with the 30 participants and the top five winners, that they should learn, continue learning, and they should use what they've learned to build a successful business.
Great initiative there from Sunlum and Startup Namibia. And that was Angie Skoltz talking to Laurentia Prinzonski.
It's The Business Report with Gary Strubel. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 103.5.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. The Financial Intelligence Center has cautioned the public that it does not license or authorize virtual asset service providers to operate or conduct business in the virtual asset space. Thus, as a recent webinar suggested, that the FIC registration of CBI Exchange Namibia should be regarded as a license for CBI to operate as a virtual asset services provider in Namibia. Agribank has extended the period of time in which Namibians under 35 years of age willing to purchase farmland have to repay their loans to 30 years, 5 years longer than clients above 35 years of age. Looking at tourism, Namibia Wildlife Resorts has announced improvements in its financial performance, having reduced its losses from 174 million in the year 2020 to 97 million Namibian dollars in 2021, while April 2022 saw overall tourism occupancy of over 36.5% compared to 27% last April and a mere 1.3% in April 2020, the month of full lockdown in Namibia. And local energy expert Aupi Atravari has called for reforms to the oil and gas industry, saying they are needed to ensure that policies accommodate Namibians to participate in the oil and gas industry so that one day we can be like the Nigerians and have a full company owned by Namibians running the oil business. Saying there is too little electricity because too many people have access to it, a new South African government strategy claims that liquefied petroleum gas, or LPG, should be the energy source of choice for cooking and heating and a natural replacement for coal or wood or paraffin. Meanwhile, staying in South Africa, according to the latest data from the Central Energy Fund, petrol and diesel prices currently look set for large increases in the first week of June, with the Automobile Association warning motorists to brace for a petrol price increase of around R3.47 a litre. Thus, as FNB estimates that it already only takes an average of 5 days for a middle-income consumer in South Africa to spend up to 80% of their monthly salaries, and economists warning they should brace for more price hikes in the coming months. Zimbabwe has lifted import duties on a range of basic goods, including rice, cooking oil, sugar, maize meal, milk powder, and soap for the next 6 months. The International Air Transport Association is optimistic about the recovery of the aviation sector, saying though that China's zero COVID policy is holding back full recovery in the Asia-Pacific region. And finally, Saudi Arabia is on track to lift oil production capacity by more than 1 million barrels per day to over 13 million barrels a day by the end of 2026 or the start of 2027. Reuters reports that Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman told an energy conference in Bahrain that production could be maintained at that level once it was reached, should market demand require it. Thus, as Africa's main oil producers and exporters are meeting in the Angolan capital Luanda, where they are seeking solutions to increase investment in the oil sector.
Namibia's business leader on Novo 103.5.
What a show. Fascinating guests this evening. Thanks for joining us as we attempt every week to bring you the biggest news happening. And there's just so much going on at the moment. It's an exciting time to be looking at business in Namibia. Lots of good initiatives, lots of great ideas coming through. We'll be taking a short break next week. We hope wherever you travel, whether you're just going to hang at home and finally get around to painting the roof, or you're going to go away somewhere, that you do it safely and do it in the company of the ones you love. Thank you for listening. You can catch this show if you missed a bit, or you want to hear perhaps more of those wonderful interviews. Lazarus Jacobs really giving great insights into his thoughts on the future of the country. Then you can go along to nova.com.na. You can check out podcasts. This episode and all our previous episodes are there as well. You can go find us on Twitter. Go look for TBR at Nova. And also you can drop us an email if you want to hear something, learn something, you want to report something, you want to give us an inside tip. That's tbr@nova.com.na. As always, thanks to the team that puts this together. Angie Schultz, our producer, David Bishop, Raymond Zierfeld, and from myself, to you mostly, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend.
That was The Business Report on Novo 103.5. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubel and produced by Limey Ilago and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.